Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at EPFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Doug Behrendt, the author of In Search of Mycotopia, Citizen Science, Fungi Fanatics, and the Untapped Potential of Mushrooms. From ecology to fermentation, in pop culture and in medicine, mushrooms are everywhere. With an explorer's eye, author Doug Behrendt guides readers through the weird, wonderful world of fungi and the amazing modern mycological movement. In Search of Mycotopia introduces us to an incredible, essential, and oft overlooked kingdom of life, fungi, and all the potential it holds for our future through the work and research being done by an unforgettable community of mushroom-mad citizen scientists and microbe devotees. This entertaining and mind-expanding book will captivate readers who are curious about the hidden worlds and networks that make up our planet. Behrendt uncovers a vanguard of mycologists, growers, independent researchers, ecologists, entrepreneurs, and amateur enthusiasts exploring and advocating for fungi's capacity to improve and heal. From decontaminating landscapes and waterways to achieving food security, In Search of Mycotopia demonstrates how humans can work with fungi to better live with nature and with one another. Well, Doug, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So as we're going through these unprecedented times during pandemic, so I suppose in a later stages now in February of 2021. I would like to start by asking, how have you been coping and what is the situation where you are?
Coping, I guess, is a relative concept, but I've been pretty lucky throughout this ordeal because when it happened or when it first started breaking out a year ago, it's crazy to think it's been a year. I was in Portland actually finishing this book and was staying at a friend's house, and it was just me there. I wasn't able to get back east where I live in New York. So I was stranded, but I was in a situation where I didn't have to pay rent and where I was comfortable and in an area that was relatively unscathed at the time. And honestly, there's too many examples to cite of just how kind of miraculous it is that I've been able to travel as much as I was doing, because I was finishing this book, the reporting for this book at the time that the virus was starting to really make its march, and, avoided contracting it and managed to get up here to my current retreat in the woods of upstate New York, where I am spending my time learning to ferment and exploring the woods and practicing guitar and getting ready to introduce people to this book. So I count myself as very, very lucky.
Yeah, for sure. Did you have any specific ways that you adjusted for your work, for example?
Oh, good. Yeah. Yeah. The coping part. I mean, for me, my work has always been remote for the most part. Obviously, reporting is complicated by this situation. And you know, any writing I've been doing has been limited to what I can do from my computer. But that works for me because traveling is not the most appealing activity at the moment. And yeah, honestly, just those other things like being outside and having the ability to do that without worrying about exposing myself or others, you know, to anything but the trees, and focusing on food and just a sort of domestic existence has really kind of helped keep me sane. You know, I'm lucky to be someone who enjoys being alone and reading and alone with the trees, which in my opinion isn't really alone, but yeah, I think it's been an opportunity to sink into a lot of the concepts that resonated with me in the process of reporting this book, which have to do with reconnecting with nature and food and just sort of being content with the abundance of what's around. You know, no intermediate step necessary, no buying anything necessary. So, yeah, another way in which I'm lucky, I guess, is that I can feel sane most times in the midst of this insane moment we're having.
Yeah, that's a really good mindset for the situation. And I think for many listeners as well, it's really reassuring to hear it because the situation in some places is still not, you know, out of the woods yet, as you would say. So that's great. All right. So you already started kind of allowing us to peer into you, what you do, like fermenting. That's interesting. Okay, we're gonna talk about that later. So can you tell me more about yourself?
Oh, where to begin? I mean, I guess just in terms of like kind of what led me to this moment and to be talking to you. The path is a weird one because I you know, I've been a freelance journalist and writer for about 10 years now. And, prior to that, it wasn't clear at all that that was what was going to happen. I actually taught music for 7 years and pursued that professionally for a while. And, before that I had ideas about becoming a fighter pilot and was very serious about joining the military, and music changed that set of priorities for me in high school. But during high school and before that, and kind of in various ways throughout my life, I've written and had a knack for writing. And I had to sort of remember at a certain point that, oh yeah, I was published in a school newspaper in seventh grade, or rather my city's newspaper in seventh grade as part of a journalism class I was in. And, you know, I was able to write at a higher level than I think, a lot of high school students at the time. And so I got encouragement to pursue it, and eventually kind of came back to it as a thing that I could do and maybe should do professionally. And then the question was just what to talk about and what to try to, you know, look into as a journalist. And I think that I came to decide to pursue writing at a time that I was also becoming a lot more sensitive to the ecological state of affairs, to the social strife and history thereof, that, you know, the consequences of which we still live with and are trying to resolve, certainly in this country. And, you know, became politically activated at that time. And so I think that intersected with a latent interest I had for technology and media. My mom was a computer teacher and a technology integrator in the school system where I grew up. And so I was looking for a long time in areas of like technology and media to find hope, basically examples of things, work, concepts, inventions that might present an alternative or a solution to the many problems that I was becoming a lot more sensitive to. And I eventually became pretty disillusioned with that whole discourse and, you know, field. I started to just recognize that it was a lot of boom and bust hype cycles, you know, and a lot of any solution that might be proposed or possible with this or that new technology or invention would only, extend as far as the market would allow, and would only be distributed according to the same rules and mechanisms that got us into the very problems we're hoping to solve with these new technologies and things. And so, I had always had this affinity for marginalized or maligned organisms somehow as a kid. I'd find myself at the beginning, I remember distinctly a period in like sixth grade. I was a young child, and instead of hanging out with the kids before class, I would go to the edge of the lawn and hang out with the snails and the mushrooms, incidentally. And there was a day when some kids came over and very performatively started stepping on all the snails and kicking over the mushrooms. And it was done just to upset me because they knew that I was, fond of these things. And I think that, another echo from the past that just started to resonate more recently, I got introduced to fungi at a time that I was becoming disillusioned with science and technology and media as a thing to write about. And, incidentally, I discovered mushrooms in the context of trying to write about technology. So the first time I wrote about them was for a technology website. I interviewed Paul Stamets, who's a very famous myco-evangelist and sort of responsible for bringing a huge number of people into awareness about this subject, and myself included. I watched a TED talk he gave and interviewed him for a tech website. And then I had at that point kind of caught the I don't want to call it the bug because that feels like mixing metaphors here, but I caught the spore. And
oh dear.
Yeah, in a good way, in a very good way. And
yeah, I like it. Good metaphor.
Thank you. And that was in like 2015 that interview happened. And from then on, it just sort of percolated or fermented in me, this interest. And I think it was partly because here was this maligned, overlooked, but crucial aspect of the natural world that, held all this promise and was also just fascinating in its own right. And, it just felt like this convergence of all of these sort of trend lines in my history and impulses and inclinations to explore something under, examined and maybe disregarded, but also very deserving of attention. And it also happened to connect with a lot of these radical communities that are looking to sort of surmount, the limitations of our society in terms of how the economy works, how we think about our responsibility to one another. The idea that that could all be wrapped up in one subject is just really compelling to me. So I hope that gives some sense of the trajectory that got me to where I am today and kind of where I'm coming from.
Excellent. So that really gives us the big picture of how you got interested and the ways, sort of the paths you chose and to follow. So I suppose it's fair to say that snails kickstarted your fascination with fungi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a weird way.
So as you went on discovering more about fungi, can you tell us the basics? What exactly is a fungus?
Yeah, that's a good question. They're an entirely distinct kingdom of life in the same way that animals and plants are distinct and represents, just vast, diverse populations of organisms that perform roles which are crucial to the functioning of life throughout the planet. And that includes every kingdom. But we're talking about as huge in terms of biomass, or comparable in terms of biomass and diversity, to these other kingdoms of life, to animals and plants, they're fungus. And they're sort of an intermediary almost. They're evolutionarily kind of halfway between plant and animal. And they sort of look that way. When you see a mushroom, it's fleshy, but it's also plant-like. And there's something really profound about that kind of weird, they represent a sort of the smooth, borderless spectrum of life that we're part of, and they show an intermediate point in that way. But what they really are is, some of them are single-celled. Many of them are multicellular in these networks that are called mycelium, and they are single-cell-wide linked strands, basically, or threads. And that's they call it the vegetative state of the fungus or form of the fungus. And that's a holdover from when science considered them to be a part of the plant kingdom. It wasn't until 1969 that they were actually formally designated as their own kingdom, which is interesting. But they exist as these fuzzy beings, these blotches that can be as small as a few plant cells or as huge as hundreds of acres, spanning entire like tracts of forest. One will often hear about the humongous fungus, they call it, in Oregon, which is the exact size of it escapes me at the moment, but it's acres and acres and thousands of years old, they think. And so the scale of possible form, or the range of possible sort of sizes they can take is pretty vast. They take all sorts of different forms. They eat all sorts of different materials, a lot of which are dead and dying leaf matter and trees and trunks and insects, animals. They eat basically everything. And their role in the ecosystem and in nature is largely one of decomposing and digesting and breaking down a formerly living thing into the means of other living things to make further life from them. So they've got this unfortunate association with death and decay, which isn't unfortunate because it's inaccurate, but because it's seen as a negative thing or a bad thing. But it's so crucial to our existence, and fungi are not just incidental to the functioning of life on this planet. They're really fundamental to it. And you'll often hear that a forest is not just tracts of fallen logs, because fungi are there to eat them and turn them into soil, which feeds entire universes of organisms down the trophic line. And then obviously most people, when they think of fungus, will think of a mushroom. And that is just the fruiting body, they call it, another linguistic holdover from their plant, their days as plants. But that's just the reproductive organ of the fungus, and a sign of this much broader hidden activity below. Fungus is not just mushrooms. It's way more than that, but mushrooms in and of themselves are so fascinating and diverse and often delicious, are enough, as far as I'm concerned, to warrant an interest in this kingdom. But it just goes so much further than that.
Yes, exactly. As you mentioned, there's such a huge diversity that it's really nice that you put it all across in your book, that you really turn people's attention to it. So even some more sort of niche investigations into solving of, for example, traveling salesman problem through sort of deterministic using deterministic approaches like a brute force, not deterministic time, so on our time scales, but without using all the resources. So have you looked into this part on the slime molds, maybe?
So you can train a slime mold on to overcome an aversion, a natural aversion that it has to something like caffeine or quinine. And once you've trained it to overcome that aversion, you take a piece of it. These are blobs. They look like they have one at the zoo in France, and they call it le blob. It really looks like the blob. It's just this little, it's like a snotty mass. You take a piece of it, and you can split it apart, merge it back together. It's just a sort of, it's an amoeba, basically. And you can take a piece of a trained slime mold that's learned to overcome its aversion to this or that substance, take that piece and combine it with another slime mold that has not learned that, has not been trained the same way, and it will carry that training through. It will like learn from the piece of the other slime mold that has been melded with it. And there's no brain, there's no nervous system. It's apparently independent cells kind of acting in an amorphous blob form, but it can remember things and it can solve problems. You know, it can find it's an optimization problem. It's not the most like convoluted thing, I guess, to determine the shortest route through a maze, but you wouldn't necessarily expect a blob of slime to be able to work that out. And so scientists have developed all sorts of interesting experiments to sort of see what's going on there and what's possible. And they've built computers using slime molds as intermediaries. They've, in my book, I interview he's an artist and an experimental philosopher is how he terms what he does. And he developed this whole program of research at Hampshire College in Massachusetts to pose like policy questions to slime molds. And so students there were designing experiments to see how they could maybe build a more equitable local transportation system using slime mold as impartial agent, you know, which the idea being that it's maybe limited in certain ways, but it's one thing it's not limited by is the biases that, you know, just the negative proclivities our government may have or our society may have towards certain groups. It's not burdened by any of that. And so you might be able to find new insights into old problems by just consulting a non-human agent. And I think as interesting as like a better and more equitable transportation system is or whatnot, more interesting to me is the idea that there's grounds to include non-human intelligence in human affairs, which being that we're living things on a completely co-created and interdependent living planet, human affairs is affairs for everything else on this planet, right? So the idea there is to enfranchise all the other stakeholders in our decision-making process. I find it quite interesting that the first sort of candidate for that is something that looks like it came out of a tissue. But I think people's aversion to that idea is sort of what, that was Jonathan Keats, was that experimental philosopher. I think that aversion is itself what he was sort of challenging and trying to invite and poke at. Like, why do we react funny or scrunch our noses if someone suggests that maybe we should ask a slime mold, you know, for its opinion or its feedback on a social problem?
So this experiment is really, really fascinating to me. And even something like optimization of the metro map. So can you maybe describe how does it look visually so listeners have a bit of understanding?
Sure, yeah. I'm realizing I've got such a clear image in my head of what I'm talking about. But
and now we all will have one, so.
Yeah, so I got to make sure you got that too. It's, so you can imagine just an orange blob that, loves oats, loves carbohydrates. And so oats are kind of the food that they're trained with most often. And the most famous experiment involved laying oats out on a map, roughly mimicking the layout of cities in Japan around Tokyo, and putting oats of different sizes to kind of represent population density, and then letting loose a slime mold into the petri dish that has these oats in this layout. And it reaches out, scans, you know, you can watch it kind of unfolding in this wave-like pattern, veiny. It's like an arterial system, and it's almost fractal. You know, the closer you look, the more the pattern repeats. And it's searching its environment. It finds oats, starts delegating, you know, more resources to consuming that oat as it looks for more. And eventually it figures out what the landscape looks like, and all of these veins and branches start to refine and collapse into arterial pathways that maybe branch in this or that direction to shuttle nutrients in an optimal way. And what you end up with after a few days is what looks remarkably like a map of the Tokyo subway system. And the idea there, the interesting thing about that is that that's a project that took years and who knows how many dollars and man hours to complete. And a slime mold did it for oats in a matter of days, you know. That's a reductive way of kind of, you know, summarizing the takeaway of it, but it's a pretty vivid example of why people find this so interesting. Like, there's a brainless thing, just a blob that was able to, you know, show it. And I've heard that the result the mold came up with was more optimized actually in certain ways than the final result, but that could be due to, you know, the limitations of working with stone versus a slime mold and oats. But I hope that gives some picture of like what it looks like. You end up with an orange veiny map of a subway system that, you know, all it took was oats.
Yes, absolutely. So that made it really, really clear. And especially when you think that it's sort of a small science project you can do during the lockdown and optimize the whole Tokyo metro system. Oh, fascinating.
Yeah, actually... Just to tag on to that, that Jonathan Keats, that artist that I mentioned, part of his project was take-home kits so that people could do these experiments at home. And apparently there was a lot of interest. And so there's a lot of people with dishes of slime mold in their cupboard somewhere, probably.
Yeah, really interesting that you can bring fungi home, sort of, you know, non-toxic ones, and do quite cool experiments with them. So you're not, really limited to just plants. You can really experiment. So we've spoken a little bit about the policy, where the slime molds and such can have their impact. So what about scientific discoveries? So we have this workhorse of molecular scientists, the Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is yeast. It's fungus, isn't it? So from a point of view of discoveries, how much did it make a difference to what we know about molecular biology?
Do you mean yeast research in particular, or I'm not sure that I can really give you a comprehensive or definitive account of like how molecular biology was like reshaped by research into yeast, but Saccharomyces, you know, a class of yeast that are very common for brewers, bakers, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, there we go, and they are used so often in brewing and bread making. They're also used massively in industry, and you know, fungi are a huge part of the enzyme production for industrial purposes throughout the world. And I think they are probably the most studied fungus around because they are kind of recodable and manipulatable. People have talked about like recoding yeast genes to produce psilocybin as a fermentative byproduct. You know, so you could brew beer that would have psilocybin in it, in theory. And that's just by dint of like toying with the genes in these relatively simple organisms that are highly responsive to modification and reprogramming and highly reliable. I mean, I guess that's the most I could probably say about that, you know, and feel kind of responsible, but, could you clarify maybe the question as far as like what you mean by like the what area of like yeast you're talking about? Or
so you mentioned food industry, so that's perfectly you know, sort of answering the question. So in terms of bioreactors, for example, you already mentioned production of some chemicals like psilocybin, but also other ones. So you can produce huge amounts of protein, right, for example,
right.
And to make vegan meat.
Right, yeah, I mean, and lots of people probably have, you know, nutritional yeast in their cupboards, and it's, I mean, it's an interesting example, I guess, at the level that I can assess it at is probably more at the level of like perceiving an organism as a mechanism that can be, you know, industrialized. And the scale at which yeast is sort of deployed and utilized at an industrial level is pretty, pretty vast. And, I mentioned in my book, an older book from like the 50s, I think, that was sort of ballyhooing yeast as this new resource for, you know, meeting all of humanity's nutrition needs, because you could set up a bioreactor on a, you know, plot of land a fraction the size of what you would need for cattle or you know, any kind of agriculture, and just produce high protein, you know, cakes basically of yeast that don't require much in the way of inputs and are highly reliable. And there was all this hope and excitement about what it would mean. But of course, we still have food scarcity today. And, you know, these you know, possibilities you know, this potential that it had to feed the world weren't realized. And I think that goes back to that point about like the systems that, you know, that define the context of these innovations is what's going to determine whether it scales, you know, or meets the needs of everybody. And so yeast is maybe a great example of that, because it is so versatile and powerful and widespread and useful. And, you know, people are still hungry. So, I think to me, the most interesting kind of aspect of that is just in kind of questioning whether the solutions to our problems lie in viewing organisms as components in an industrial process.
Yes, for sure. It has great potential to perhaps even something like fermentation to produce longer lasting foods with a higher nutritional content, but it's all on the balance of where and how and how much does it cost, isn't it?
Yeah, who gets it? You know, who gets to eat that food? Who has access?
And, yeah, and we're back to distribution problem, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe slime mold can help us with that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. There we go. All right, so we covered the scientific part. So let's talk about the culture. So there was a really interesting word in your book, which is anarchomycologist. So can you describe who are anarchomycologists?
The first person who introduced me to this side of the mycological world was Olga Sogas, who is the sole proprietor of a small mushroom company in Rochester, New York, called Smugtown, Smugtown Mushrooms. And I visited her with the idea of just reporting on this kind of anti-capitalist mushroom business that was trying to stay afloat. And like, how is that even possible? Her whole concept seemed to be one of like serving her community, building a community and sort of serving it. And she really wanted to do her work in the context of like a mutual aid sort of arrangement, where people basically like a socialist or communist kind of like picture of the world that, I mean, I think there's political implications to that point of view, but it didn't seem like it was coming from a political place. It seemed like she was just tired of having to like all she wanted to do was grow mushrooms, share that excitement, bring people in, provide medicine and food to her community. But she had to think about, you know, how much it was going to cost to move the autoclave and how to not get screwed by the landlords who, like, the building she was in was passing into the hands of these people who wanted to replace it with a beer garden. And so she had to go, you know, and so like all of the frustrations of operating in the context of capitalism were getting to her. And, you know, all the people that were working there were very like punk, you know, and they all had like, denim vests and Motorhead patches and, you know, and also these mushrooms that sort of like somehow seemed to really fit in with that kind of punk attitude as symbols. And I had never even considered that before I like stepped into the midst of this space where all these mushrooms are growing out of, you know, bags, and there's humid air and weird smells and fluids being transferred between beakers and stuff, and also like rock records and all this, you know, countercultural kind of energy. So the anarcho-mycologist in my mind is someone who's, you know, become fascinated with fungi, has built some sort of working relationship with them, whether professionally or just for its own sake, and who represents this move that I've seen kind of in various forms of expression throughout the country to seize fungi as like a symbol and a motivator or example of shifting society in a direction that's more equitable, respectful to nature, rather like that one that centers nature. Eventually, like very quickly, the conversation verges outside of fungi, and we're talking about, you know, like redistribution of land and, you know, sustainable and equitable food systems and stuff like that. So a lot of these people who are, you know, they're mycologists, they study fungi and they work with fungi. The project they're really looking to, and from what I've seen, is much bigger than that, and is actually more like social ecological at those levels. And so, yeah, I guess that's sort of the sense I have for what an anarcho-mycologist is. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. And what I'm interested in is there any sort of central organization, or is it mostly people like Olga, like you describe, who decided to become one, but is not really interested in getting other people interested? Or how does this culture work?
Right. Well, I would say she's definitely interested in getting people interested. I mean, she's a communicator of this stuff, and a lot of these people end up teaching it as well, because there's this huge gap of knowledge in the general public around fungi. Most people don't know what they are, how they live, or anything. You know, even if you know the bare basics of like what a plant is or how it works, it's far more than most people know about how fungus works. And so a lot of these people end up educating, and I think a lot of networks form across the country through, you know, this growing interest in fungi. So there's a lot of people looking to learn. There's a lot of economic opportunity. That's a reason a lot of people want to learn too. And so I think that's a sort of a foundational structure for this community, is just educating people. And then there's also an economic kind of dimension to it. Like a lot of these people make tinctures and extracts and sell, you know, fresh mushrooms for medicinal or food purposes. And they work with restaurants in their area, or they sell spawn bags, you know, with basically like a starter for mushrooms that someone can grow themselves. You know, there are these various kind of ways to serve the mushroom economy, which is growing. And so there's also a lot of excitement about how that might look in the future, and what it could mean for like food security and resilience. But yeah, I think the culture, you know, obviously it's mediated a lot by the internet, and there's a huge like mushroom Instagram world and mushroom Facebook world, and they're very visually appealing or engaging or alluring, intriguing, you know, organisms. And so I think they're just sort of perfect for social media posts. And I think that's driving a lot of the growth in their interest lately. But yeah, the network, the sort of North America is where my focus is really, you know, at in this book. And I've just in the last 5 years seen what was really a bi-coastal kind of community start to overlap and form. And to my mind, the picture is one of like fungal threads kind of reaching across the country and forming a big mat, you know, like a singular organism. And I genuinely feel like that's happening, and not in any small way due to the fact that these people think in terms of mycological metaphors a lot of times, and they'll talk about sporulating and myceliating as what they're doing, you know, as a way of looking at their project in life and their professional project. Like they've got ideas, they've come to some insight or you know, sublime, profound relationship to nature that they want to, you know, stay with in their life, but also share. And they find ways of doing that in a lot of ways. In a lot of cases, that's through education. It's through, you know, finding ways of developing, you know, a business. But it was an interesting thing to sort of experience, like all these people who are doing this stuff, most of them in my experience were doing it kind of for its own sake. And were like, just trying to find a way to make it work so that they could do it. They weren't necessarily trying to like make it rich, make a fortune on mushrooms. Although there are some people who are trying to do that.
So how do you see this culture evolving? Do you think it will be absorbed into the mainstream or perhaps become a part of environmentalist movement?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because it can sort of seem like a trend or a fad. You know, mushrooms are popular right now, and I think that's why this book is getting any attention at all. There's a public kind of curiosity about fungi, and my concern is that like all of these sort of innocent, earth first, you know, attitudes that resonated with me in this space might just get pushed to the side as capital steps in and, you know, decides the shape of things moving forward, because it tends to do that. And, here's this kingdom of life, this massive dimension of our living world that is only now coming to public attention and even to the attention of science in a lot of ways. And so there's all this opportunity, like, how are we going to relate to these organisms? What are we going to do with them and like with them in a partnership sense or in a like an extractive sense? You know, it could go either way. And I think I hope that this is a moment of like sufficient uncertainty in the world. And I should rephrase that. I think the world is in a state where maybe we can recognize the value in approaching this thing differently, you know, as a society. And I think a lot of people are looking for alternatives and looking for hope in the midst of some pretty dire times. And fungi, you know, we hear from prominent people, like they literally say, you know, mushrooms can save the world. They can do all these things that are really useful for us. They can heal landscapes and clean waterways and provide food and medicine. And all that is true with, you know, caveats, but, that's only going to be helpful to us if we can kind of change the way we pursue those outcomes, instead of just trying to plug it back into the same old system. So my hope is that the kind of message of the mushroom, you know, one of like serving a role in an ecosystem rather than trying to master it, looks to like local and distributed kind of mechanisms. I mean, like fresh mushrooms, for example, they don't travel very well. And so there's an automatic kind of limiting factor to that industry or to that market that means that it stays geographically bound for the most part. And so there's some dimensions to just how fungi work and what working with them looks like that gives me hope that it might actually facilitate some changes in the way we think and operate, the more people become interested and sort of hear the message. And I guess that was sort of my hope with this book, was to like give that dimension of it a voice, and to take that thread that I was seeing in these, you know, communities and among these people and sort of make that the center of things rather than like, hey, maybe mushrooms can clean up our oil spills or replace styrofoam or whatever, which is, I think, what dominates the conversation these days. And I think if we're looking at it like that, then it's just going to get subsumed, you know, and it's either going to get marginalized as part of like eco-activism or whatever, or it's going to, you know, become another playground for capital. And my hope is that, you know, at a time when we need to be subverting the latter thing in particular, in my opinion, maybe this is a good time to boost the signal of the people who are sort of taking what to me are the best messages, you know, from this dimension of life and the work they're doing with it and how they're kind of trying to factor that work into another way of organizing their communities and, you know, ultimately with any luck, society at large. But that's just my hope. We'll see.
Well, learning all that about mushrooms got me really scared that they can take over the world. The way they, for example, can grow in the nervous system of ants or take over them, turn them into zombie ants, zombie bees.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of mushroom cultivators will joke that they've fallen victim to some strain of fungus that has just conscripted them into lifelong service, but none of them seem to be that unhappy about it, to be honest. So maybe we could all use a fungal influence in our thinking.
So for you, what would be the first steps that we can practically do towards the more equitable sort of ideal world where fungi are being integrated into our society, you know, on the medicinal level or the agricultural level or in any of these ways?
Yeah. You know, honestly, I feel like the only suggestion I could make is just to learn about them. Because, you know, I think from what I've seen, they take people in different directions. And it's in large part kind of a stand-in for just learning about nature or becoming sensitive to nature. I mean, for me, you know, I grew up hiking in the outdoors, and like I said, I had a relationship with, like, you know, living things, and got really obsessed with insects for a while. And yet there was this relationship, like in a personal sense with nature, that I had not formed. And I only came to realize that after getting into fungi, because it brought my attention to all of these other aspects of nature. Like, oh, you want to look for mushrooms in the woods? You have to learn about this or that tree that mushroom associates with. You have to start paying attention to the aspect of the land, to the climate conditions, the microclimate conditions. You know, getting into mushrooms in any kind of, you know, vigorous way necessarily requires learning more about everything else in nature, because it connects to everything in nature. And I think through that, people find all sorts of ways of practicing and, you know, deepening that path. So, like, you know, it's very easy to find, at least in the US, like grow kits that you grow mushrooms at home from a cardboard box. You know, you just add water. It's really that simple. And just that simple step of growing mushrooms in your kitchen, I think unveils tons of insight into, you know, what life is, you know, how life works, and certainly how these specific organisms work. And I think it sparks, you know, it may just fill your belly that evening, you know, for dinner, or it might do as it's done for so many others and spark curiosity that takes you in new directions. So, you know, trying new mushrooms, going foraging, that was the big one for me, was going foraging with Olga, because she was someone who really knows how to find mushrooms, and being with her in the woods meant that the woods took on a completely different character, and kind of lit up with mushrooms that I had never even heard of before, but which were incredible, like mind-blowing mushrooms, like the artist's conch, they call it, which grows out of the sides of trees, and it has this ceramic white belly that you can draw on with your finger. It bruises purple as you touch it. And so people draw messages on these mushrooms. I'd never seen one before, and I drew a little happy face on it. And lion's mane was growing from a tree. I'd never heard of lion's mane before, but there was this, and it's a very prime, like it's a high price. It's like $20 a pound or so here. And there was at least a pound of it growing off of a tree, and cut it off with a knife, and we were grilling it that evening, you know, and the sense of abundance that came from that, and my kind of perspective on what's happening in the woods started to shift in such a profound way, that, like, really the best advice I can think to give right now is just go to the woods and look for them with someone who knows how to find them, or try growing them at home. Just take a step. And I mean, if you're listening to this, I assume you're curious a little bit, and the first step you take is likely to be the first of many. So that would be my advice.
Yes, and I think your book is a perfect introduction to this fascinating topic. It sort of leads you to explore more. Well, Doug, we've taken up a lot of your time. So can you tell us, what is your current project?
Well, my current project is sauerkraut I'm making in the kitchen right now, and preparing to talk to people about this book. And I'm applying for a a fellowship at the moment because I'm not sure how much more kind of freelance writing I want to do after this very rewarding experience of writing a book. So I'm starting to consider how to get ready for the next one, which I have some ideas about, but probably too early to even hint at them. But this was a great experience, and I'm preparing for preparing to see what happens, what comes of it. The book isn't even out yet as we speak, and what the world will look like for me after it comes out is still kind of an open question. But I know that the process of creating it has changed my life in such enriching ways that that's something I'd like to try again.
Do you think it can be sort of time to reflect as well, just to have this time to yourself rather than rushing into something else?
Yeah. And you know, I guess what I just said is probably a long way of saying that that's what I'm doing. It was a kind of an unexpected thing, honestly, to write this book. And so, you know, over a very chaotic couple of years that straddled this pandemic, and my mother passed away as well last year. And so it was like this very trying and chaotic year for everybody, obviously, 2020. But the whole process of writing this book was intense and transformative. And so I'm still kind of taking stock of what that means to me and what to do with all that has happened over the last few years. So, really my hope is just to spend the next few months introducing people to this amazing subject of fungi and these amazing people that are doing such interesting and entertaining in a lot of ways, like work with them. And I hope that it draws people down that path of curiosity that I'm still walking myself, and I'm so happy I found.
Excellent. So where can our listeners find more information about your work and the book?
Great. I'm most easy to find on Twitter at Doug Bierand, or on Instagram, same name. And that's probably where you'll find me for the time being, unless a publication that you follow happens to run an article I write. But I'm easy to find.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.